Okay, this is not really a talk on GRBs as such. It's on explosions, cosmic explosions. It sort of will be a curious mix of sort of technological advances and a theory that, in fact, even string theories will understand. Okay, so come into the lion's den and get things going, okay. And hopefully there'll also be some signal. I was a little worried that David only mentioned the noise part. Okay, so let's understand a bit. If you look at the sky background, as you go from gamma rays to radio, the sky background increases dramatically. In fact, we all know at radio wavelengths, there's a very fixed sky background, no matter which you can never escape, which is a 3 Kelvin background. In contrast, the gamma ray sky is very, very dark. There are very few discrete sources. There is a faint emission from the galactic plane. Okay, and this has huge effect on how astronomers have gone about discovering transients, actually. And so if you have something where the sky background is very low, then you can always build an instrument whose field of view is very large. In fact, I used to make a joke about gamma ray astronomers. I would say one photon is a detection, two a time series, and three is the Bruno Rossi Prize, which is the biggest prize in this field. But so that's what it really is all about, right? You make an omnidirectional detector, and suddenly you expect on an average 0.1 photon per second, and it goes up to 2. That's it. You can write a paper. And okay, and that's why gamma ray bursts came into our horizon first, because they're the easiest technically to discover in this sense. This field didn't go much because it's one thing to detect, and this is a problem. It's one thing to detect. You can always discover a thing with two photons, but to localize, that's not good enough. Okay, so that's why the field lagged behind, but it's going up. So at gamma ray wavelengths, you can do this without any imaging techniques. You can use a variety of approaches. You can either do very simple geometric. So you have a collimator, which just means a tube, lead tube, you know, that looks at that piece of the sky, and you have a whole bunch of them. You take ratios and you know roughly where it is. But as you go to X-ray wavelengths, you have to do quasi-imaging because the background is high now. There are thermal plasma emission from our own galaxy. The discrete sources start coming up. And so one of the more popular techniques is to do shadow imaging, which is not really full imaging because it makes images, but the background is still that of the whole sky. And in fact, that's more or less how all these X-ray and hard X-ray detectors work. And then you come to optical. The background is decidedly very large. You can see with your own eyes, there are lots of discrete sources. There's reflected light from nebula. There's direct light from nebula and so on. And you can do incoherent imaging, by which I mean, you know, you can just get a Celestron thing, put a CCD, and you're in business. And many people sort of would like to do this sort of astronomy where, by incoherent, I mean the fact is you're not using the diffraction properties of the wave and so on and so forth. You come to radio wavelengths, you can't even do that. You have to do the ultimate imaging, which is coherent imaging, which means you have to recognize there's a wave, there's constructive interference, you make an exact point spread function. So there's no question the complexity of your back-end instrument increases as you go down. So it's a question of time before. So we are sort of, you know, been there, done that. We're almost here. And this is what I'd like to talk about. And not much on the last bit because it's harder and harder. So we'll put something here. Okay. So the GRB06 is sort of a kind of, you know, a wake. The field's over, so we're having a nice wake here. God, this. Oh well, okay. Right. So I thought I'll just go through some basic transients because I am the thing that I've been thinking for the last 6 months is I think the progress that will happen in this field is going to be by technology. So it's one of these things where you don't discoveries happen, and the only question is, can you anticipate months ahead or post facto? So I want to be a little at least months ahead. So I thought I'll just go back to the very basics of this thing. And so I thought I'll write down some basic physics. And I guarantee you, and this is my big problem with many physics colloquia, you go to this physics colloquia, you never understand the details. It's sort of level, it's either very mathematical or there's no equation. So I guarantee you, this equation you come across in your whole life, and you can do it too, as soon as you go back to your office. Okay, so we have an explosion. So let's assume there's an explosion, radius r, r naught, initial radius r naught, m ejecta, I simply call that is the debris. We'll say the thing explodes. It may not necessarily be the full mass of the star, it's just stuff that comes off. Okay, and we want to know what is the radiation we'll see from this exploding gas, which has a certain temperature, a certain energy. Okay, I'll write down all the equations you ever need to know in this game. So if E is the total energy of the explosion, by which I mean it is both the kinetic energy of the debris flying off as well as the radiation, and that's far more important actually in astronomical terms. So that's the total energy. That's equal to, as we all know, it's simply the thermal energy plus the radiation part. So this I just doing E over V, so it's per unit volume. The volume is, going back to kindergarten, is that. And then we'll write down, then the pressure is the sum total of the gas plus photon pressure. Z is the usual atomic charge. We'll allow for hydrogen Z equals 1. And finally, this is unfortunately the most important equation, so let me write this down, because this part we all know. This is the rate of change of this ball. What's going to happen? Well, you can add energy to it. For example, if the ejecta is radioactive, which is an important thing in this context, and you can certainly subtract energy from it simply by radiation or by expansion, which is the PdV work. Okay, so let me say I have some heat that I add, which is per gram epsilon of T, because the radioactivity, I must account for the fact that it changes with time. Well, I'm going to radiate something away, which is the luminosity, which is just the surface radiation. And I'm going to do mechanical work, 4 pi r squared. This is a PdV work. And velocity is that of the... So this is obviously a simple model. It doesn't account for the fact that there's some radial structure and so on and so forth. That's it. So we're in business now. But we need to make some simplification. If you want to sort of, you can do this numerically, but if you want to do it easy, then we make some simplification. We assume that the radius increases linearly with time, which means there's sort of no acceleration after the explosion. Of course there is. In the beginning, the object has zero velocity with respect to mean, and then it starts. But these things happen quickly, we don't care. We just want the terminal coasting velocity after some time t, which is very quick. And then this is the part I like in astrophysics. You really can sort of, if you know the right thing to do, you can just get rid of all the complexities by seemingly simple equations and looking very, very scholarly actually at the same time. Okay, this is in fact the biggest approximation, which says, let's say there's the energy in the photons is E photon, which is obviously this part here, okay? And then I'll say there's a thing called diffusion time, defined such that the ratio of this is the luminosity, okay, which you can see this is where, of course, if the real physics matters. But fortunately, for people like me, I just sort of look around very quickly, scan some books, and what you don't know, you put fudge factors and you get going. And generally it works. Okay. So it's easy to write down the diffusion time, except, obviously it's a density times the relevant opacity, kappa, times the length scale. But all of this is captured in B, which you need to actually work out, either it's a spherical case, a slab, how many scatterings allowed. Okay, I'll ignore that for right now, because I'm not a theorist. I'm sort of like, let's get something approximately right, and then we're done. Okay, so at this point, with this simplification, which looks reasonable, and this is where the real physics is, I told you how a computer beat B. I can now go ahead and do it in two cases. I can say, let me consider a radiation-dominated explosion. Well, if it is a radiation-dominated explosion, then you know that the pressure is one-third the energy density. We all know this. Okay, and then let's assume that there's no heat input. Okay, well, then you can get a well-known solution which says that the explosion energy, the luminosity, goes as a... And I'll tell you in a minute what these are. Okay. So this says the explosion is pretty much flat top, so you can ignore this. So basically up to time tau, it'll be flat and then it'll decrease very rapidly. So it's sort of roughly, you can see that this is approximately L as a function of time. It is this, and this is tau, and this is L naught. Okay, and that's all we need to know. There's no need to do final calculation and this sort of business. Tau H is what's called the initial hydrodynamic scale, which is going at the speed of explosion, how much time it takes for to cross the initial progenitor star. And tau D, zero, is the same thing, but evaluated at R equals R naught, okay, the initial diffusion time. You can also do this, and you know, I'm not a theorist, so I was a little proud to sort of discover this little solution which hadn't been published. Because always when you read these sorts of things, you sort of discover something and then you found it was, you know, either published by someone in 50s or worse still, you go to a colloquium and say, I found something, and someone says, oh, back in 49 I wrote this something. Okay, so far no one's done this to me, so. Okay, you can actually do this in the other case, which is slightly interesting, because most astronomers assume these are radiation-dominated things. And of course, that's good, because that's the only ones you can see. So if you just have an explosion where gas pressure only dominates over this, then you find the same thing, but now L is proportional to, let me call this L photon. L is proportional to L photon divided by T over, roughly speaking, tau H. So it falls off so much more rapidly, these explosions are very hard to see. Okay, we're almost done. So L naught, of course, is the initial luminosity. It's proportional to the velocity square of the explosion times the size of the progenitor star. And tau, the time scale on which this happens, is proportional to the mass of ejecta over velocity square root. Okay, so at this point we have done sort of what we need to know about basic explosions all written down here. Now, we can make this a little bit more complicated. And if you notice, I used only one equation here, which is the conservation of energy. And I skipped by cleverly saying, oh yeah, it'll accelerate and then it'll coast. Of course, the real solution is you want to do both energy and momentum. And this is a more famous solution that only classical physicists would know, because this is the Sydow-Taylor solution, which was worked out for a nuclear bomb explosion, where you also not very interested in the final thing. You really want to see the development of velocity. Okay, and you can do that too. Actually, it's not very difficult, but it's not relevant for our calculations here. Okay, so the one last thing I'd like to do is I'll focus today on non-relativistic explosions, by which I mean this velocity is less than, obviously, speed of light. GRBs are relativistic explosions, and you probably heard enough of them, so I thought we'll do something different. Okay, so... I mean, this may shock some of you into sort of saying, well, this seems incredibly rough, but you know, astrophysics is the art of what's possible. It's no astrophysicist becomes famous by saying this doesn't exist. You know, whereas Fermi and Dirac got famous by saying, oh, this is excluded, that's excluded, and so on. We get famous by actually discovering stuff. So this sort of business, you have to think differently. You have to think very, very differently. There's absolutely no value for negative people at all in that field. Okay. So I'll say, okay, I'm looking the focus, what I've been thinking last 6 months is, I'm looking for optical stuff. So we know that the temperature of the emitting plasma cannot be 100 Kelvin. The wean tail kills you. Well, it can be a million, but it's sort of a waste then to go use optical detectors. So the ideal thing is, you know, maybe 10,000 Kelvin, which is 2 eV. Okay? So it doesn't mean that everything is wrong. It's just that this is ideally suited. And if there are such million Kelvin expanding blobs, well, that's no problem. The X-ray guys will get it, and they probably have it. So we'll just look out for this. So I'll assume T equals 10 to the 4 Kelvin. And so basically by this, I'm assuming that I'm looking at the peak, nu F nu peaks, as you know, at a few eV, which is the right energy range. And then I say, what is L? The luminosity of a black body, and of course black body, because it's optically thick. That's what we're working out at this point. If it is thin, I'll lose out again by the optical depth, so I'm not interested in that. So is, again, very simply, okay, you've seen this before. And then we'll again do the simple coasting thing, and you'll see that L goes as V square T square, and this roughly divides the space we want to go after as if I put V equals C, I get what's brighter than this would be relativistic explosions, and fainter than this, because it's V square, is going to be non-relativistic. So we'll just sort of want to confine ourselves here. Okay. So now to show you this diagram. What this diagram shows, which I tried to draw as accurately as I could, what this shows is, if you wish, this is L naught. Okay? And this is a tau, which I call as the time to peak. So this is the peak luminosity versus the time to peak. Okay? So this equation which separates, or this line which separates relativistic from non-relativistic is shown here, so this, by this dotted line. I got a little fancy, I put gamma beta equals 1 rather than just, you know, V equals C, that's all. And so anything in brighter and faster, and this is, oh, let's go through a length scale. So these are in units of magnitudes. And astronomers have two levels of gatekeepers for this sort of business. The first level is we want to keep string theory south. I mean, they're generally smart guys, but, you know, we don't really all those guys. So by just throwing in some real unit like ergs and that, they disappear. They just disappear. Okay? That turns out to be easy. And I'm not kidding. I remember once we were interviewing a string theory, so I said, okay, man, I know. Some people think in our division I'm a sort of a wild card, so they always send candidates as a sort of like. And I said, hey, you know, I heard of this dark energy. You know, what is it in, like, energy density? He said, 1. I said, it's amazing. Everything works out to be 1. And then it turned out it's 1 in his world of units chosen to be 1. Okay, and then we spent the next hour working out what 1 means in any unit, CGOs or MKs. I'm flexible. Okay, so that turns out to be easy. Though with this, maybe the string theorists will say, you know, maybe this stuff is something we should do. It's not so difficult. But the next level, we get past those, then we have these condensed matter types. How do we get rid of those? That's it. Okay? This is our magic. I won't tell you what it is, other than it's proportional to luminosity. And it's got some weird minus 20. Look at these things. It is actually a physical quantity here. Okay. So we'll not talk about this today. Time scale, 0.1 days, 100 days. Why am I doing on 0.1 days? We are talking of GRBs, you know, 10 seconds. Yeah, it's all right. I mean, my view is that this sort of a game, you have to sort of get a rough idea of what is feasible and what's not. So my view is that this is the range that's technically feasible now. One of these days, people will have telescopes, and may not be far away, maybe 2 years away, but my horizon is always a few months. Right now, this is where we can go. So 0.1 days to 100 days, okay? So that's the phase we're looking at. So what we have here are, if you have pure explosion of some white dwarf-like object, that is an object which is radius of Earth, it explodes for whatever reason. We're not too worried. Pure explosion, there's nothing, there's no epsilon of T subsequently. It'll be here at about 0.1 days at about minus 8 magnitude. Okay? It'll be there. Basically, this is the time scale on which that explosion energy, photon energy, will leak out. That's all it is. Okay? It's a bit difficult to find, but remember that it goes here. Where is it? Yes. This is the key thing. Goes as R naught. So you want larger star, better it is. Photons take a longer time to leak out. If you have what's called a certain kind of supernovae, 1BC, whose size, the progenitor size, is sort of similar to that of the Sun. Obviously, the radius is larger. They also have more ejecta and so on. So it's things conspire to give. So it's at about minus 15 magnitude or so. Let me make sure that's right. Yeah, minus 14. So this should be a bit lower here. Lasting about, you know, a couple of days. Feasible. And if you have a giant star, which is 100 times the radius of Sun, and such stars exist, that will go on for many days and will be much brighter. Very easy to find those things. However, all these require you to be surveying the sky with a cadence which is meaningful for their durations. If you want to find something at 0.1 days, you better have a cadence, I don't know, at least 0.01, so you actually see it rise, fall down, and you get convinced. And that sort of cadence, and also the phenomena should be very common, so that if you do this thing the whole year, you know, you don't get like the mean probability of 0.1. So actually these have been rather difficult to find in this, what I call as naked explosions, without just the very simple explosion, for whatever the cause, has been difficult. Okay. So one of the first things that will happen, I would say, in the next few years is that people will find these sort of things routinely, because the cadence and basically the solid angle coverage has increased dramatically. So you're always assured of getting, you know, a few in a year, that which would make it meaningful. However, this game has been around even without this sort of basic explosions, and the reason is of this quantity. Okay, the reason we see at all is the heat input. And there are two families here. There are two families. One is for supernovae, and the other is novae. Okay? 100 years ago, astronomers didn't make a distinction. They simply called them Nova Stella, which is a new star. But then, over 100 years, we learned that this Nova Stella family, in fact, there's a whole group, supernovae. It's absolutely no relation to novae, at least in the simplest sense of the word. And then supernovae, and within supernovae there are variations, somewhat minor, but within novae there are dramatic variations. You can have black hole, white dwarf, neutron star, and you can have disk and surface instabilities. And since black hole doesn't have a surface, instead of getting six families, you get five. Okay, so when people say that GRB stuff is done, which sometimes, of course, I make fun of the GRB crowd, which tends to be a bit serious, I think. You know, it's okay. The first part of the game is over. But it won't be surprising if there turn out to be families within this that we'll find out through hard work and that sort of stuff. Okay, so the supernovae, they shine here mainly, amazingly enough, and they'll shine for a long time, very nicely. You know, go on for a month. Maybe even several months, which is convenient for astronomers to date, because it means you make an image of the sky today or some part of it, go back a week later, make a part, and you know, there's no rushing around in this sort of business, so you can find them, and the rate is not negligible, so it's an industry now. And the way these things have is they have an epsilon of T coming solely or mainly from these explosions themselves create, synthesize elements of which a dominant element is 56 nickel, which decays on a time scale of 6 days to 56 cobalt, which then decays on a time scale of 77 days, which is the E-folding time scale, to 56 iron. Okay, take this away. Take this creation of the supernova, you'd be forced into rushing around to catch this little asterisk sort of events, which are hard. Okay, that's a supernova. What happens here for novae? For novae is a hot central source. Okay, so it's very different. And what happens in ANOVA is you have a compact object, which for most ANOVA we traditionally mean a white dwarf, though one can now start thinking of other possibilities. A white dwarf, it accumulates some matter and then undergoes thermonuclear instability as there's more envelope. But the white dwarf is hot for a certain length of time, and so it supplies this epsilon of T. In fact, as the ANOVA expands, eventually when it becomes optically thin, you can see the hot white dwarf. And you can see they have different, and this is called MMRD, maximum magnitude weight of decay relation. This is how ANOVA are. These are fast ANOVA and these are slow ANOVA. This sort of thing you have to, you know, again, these are low-level filters to keep the riffraff out. So there are ANOVA class and all this. And long time ago, you know, just only what, 80 years ago, astronomers thought this is the way to get distances. And it's hard to believe that some papers even still talking about this is the way to get distances. Okay, this is not a great exact relation. It's a rough relation. It's easy to understand why faster ANOVA are brighter in this model. It's also easy to understand why supernovae, which are brighter, are slower. You can see they have different slopes in this diagram. Okay, so I think...
Can I just ask a naive question?
Yeah.
I'm looking at the equations over here on the left.
Yeah.
So in these two curves, what is it that's varying along the curve? Is it the mass of the...
For supernovae, it is the mass of the ejector. It's a little complicated. Okay, one of the fundamental variations certainly is the mass of the white dwarf. Okay, and the reason I'm hesitating is there's more than one important physical parameter in ANOVA. Certainly the mass of white dwarf, because that sets the scale of the, you know, because the radius is related to mass to the minus 1/3. But it also depends on the temperature of the white dwarf, because the actual instability is temperature dependent. So the answer would unfortunately have to vary with what you tell me is the mean temperature. In steady state, if you allow me to carry this exercise again and again, then the only variation really should... No, but he's talking about just the MMRD.
Maybe I can ask my question. Why are these things lines?
Well, I told you, I already told you that don't be deceived by this as to better than a factor of 10 you can understand these things. I disagree there, but not enough. It's not some amazing, you know, because their accretion rate, mass of the white dwarf, are two independent parameters here, and the mean temperature, which is the history of white dwarf.
So there's not such a big connection with the equations just over here.
These are exactly calculable.
Right. I mean, this on top of the ANOVA case is not.
I didn't write down the ANOVA case at all, because that would take a long time. I simply said the physical reason why you have these is because there's an extended heat source. We have here because of radioactivity. That's all I was trying to point out. Okay. Well. So we've seen supernovae up to a certain sort of factor of 10 variation. They go from this peak to this is about, I don't know, 10. Yeah, about 10, okay? And you see novae all the way from 100 days to a few days. There's a pretty big variation. And there's lots of data here, okay? This is a reasonable relation, not just accurate to do distances, but good enough to understand this. And then now there's this curious gap here. This is between roughly about minus 16 to about minus 10. This is gap. Okay. As I said, it'll be only a foolish astronomer would write a paper saying there are no objects in this gap and I hope I'll get tenure or something. And in fact, you should write a paper, even if you didn't know anything, there are objects in the gap, because then 30 years later you can sit in the audience and say, oh, back in 2006, okay, it's very important in our field to always write papers even with no data at all. Okay, so that makes, you know, this, you know, some people have remarked on this gap and said, oh, well, what it is. So I've been thinking a little bit, and this gap, there are some objects now. There are so-called luminous blue variables. They're very rare objects. They're the most massive objects. They're not explosions in the traditional sense of the word. And there are some interesting things which I'll come down to, you know, with names other astronomers will recognize. But the part that I sort of want to go in here are sort of, this is what I've been focusing on for a while, is short of any other thing, I call objects which are brighter than novae here, fainter than supernovae, sort of macronova, which are big nova, but I mean, you could also call it mini supernova, which is a bit silly. I think you'd agree with that. Okay. So, and the reason I was thinking of this is, supposing you have, I'm not the first one to have thought through, but I think I've done this calculation more carefully, is let's say you have two neutron stars. They coalesce. Okay? And this is, as you well know, major expectations for future gravitational wave observatories. They coalesce, they may give rise to so-called short hard gamma ray bursts. And then the most naive model you can think of, well, most of it goes into a black hole, but maybe a tenth, hundredth, thousandth solar mass won't go into the black hole. Okay. And the most naive model is all these neutrons are, of course, thanks to their very high Fermi energy, confined from doing the beta decay. Okay. But as soon as you remove this, in 10 minutes, they will undergo they're free electrons, they'll undergo decay. Well, at that point, you can get 0.78 MeV per decay in the form of an electron which carries this kinetic energy from the decay. So then you can work out, you know, then I've done this sort of stuff, and the reason it's not as straightforward as some of the earlier work is, you really do have to worry whether this is a photon explosion or just a hot explosion. Hot explosions don't matter. And for that, you have to make sure that the number of photons you're radiating are in fact generated somewhere in the system. So you have to actually write another equation, which is just the conservation of the number of photons, or photon production equation, which I've, you know, it's pretty straightforward for any competent theorist. But for an observer like me, it was a six-month undertaking. Okay. But I tried to get a postdoc. My usual attitude is, you know, I'm sort of very lazy about many things, so I tried to round up one of the theory postdocs, say, hey, this is interesting, why don't you do this, you know, and he said no, and then I said, well, you know, it couldn't be all that difficult, it's not like these guys are all that smart, so just took me. So anyway, I hacked through it, and it was good. As I said, it's good for the soul. I'm a very soulful guy now, and I can do this. Anyway, so these models now predict that if I have these explosions with even free neutron decay, well, then you say, oh, come on, this is so absurd, you know. You have these things, and what's to tell you that if I take two neutron stars and bash them, and as suddenly the Fermi energy is reduced, they'll become free neutrons. They may become europium or some god-awful clusters and so on. And the answer is, yeah, it's true. But who knows? I mean, this sounds like a nightmare to get into, so I said, oh well, the one thing I know is free neutron. And you can put in other things if you want. And it's a huge industry. Anyone in nuclear physics, you don't have much to do, you can work out this problem. It's great. But the problem is very simple. I have a small amount of matter which was under high Fermi energy. I remove it. What happens to it? Okay? And my view is that maybe even if a third of it is free neutrons, I'm there to a third, which is good enough. Okay. So, and this is the dotted track. That's what this will do. And for the kinds of numbers, if you look at the coalescence models, you know, we are talking of 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2 solar masses. This is reasonable. This is what my models tell you. Okay. What are the other possibilities? The other possibility is I consider two neutrons decaying and some rapid radioactivity like neutrons. What about if I have stellar coalescence? I just have two plain stars. They're not degenerate. Two sun-like stars, and they may coalesce. Why would that be? Well, it's very common, actually. If you have two stars, you have to start off with the right parameters. If it's two stars, one guy starts, let's say, a little bit ahead, expands into subgiant, red giant, starts transferring matter, and then inevitably these things will, in fact, merge. And in which case, there's another source of energy, which is simply you have to say, what is the binding energy of the orbit, binding energy of the two stars, and the final binding energy of the merged system? You find, in fact, that there's a tremendous amount of energy that is released in such a coalescence. And the question is how, on what time scale it comes up. And these may well be those sorts of objects. So these may be short, hard bursts, and one of the best models for these sorts of things is a simple merger of ordinary stars, that is, non-degenerate stars. Okay, well, so the key thing here is how to proceed next. And, you know, I'm sort of a little hesitant because I'm going to share with you my sense of strategy for the next 6 months. And, oh, well, what the hell. So, okay. So the key thing... So the key thing here is to recognize that this is roughly speaking, this is the Eddington luminosity. Now the Eddington luminosity is important for this. It's a scale that's very important. Eddington luminosity is, let's say I have a star, and then I put a proton and electron on the surface of the star. Okay, it doesn't matter whether they're bound or not bound, okay, in this problem at all. Okay. The electron feels Thomson scattering from the radiation, so it'll try to fly away. And of course, to preserve charge neutrality, eventually it drags the proton away. So that's why I said it doesn't matter if it's bound or not bound. So because we are trying to compute the minimum luminosity, if it's bound, you have to worry about the transitions, which we are not. Okay, so we're just doing a very simple thing. I have sigma t, it's going to push this electron away. What is the level of luminosity at which you will then drive the surface away? Okay, and clearly you can see that stars above that luminosity are in a precarious position of blowing themselves apart from their own radiation pressure, and the ones below that are stable. And objects like this, LBVs, they actually kind of hang around here, roughly speaking. And once in a while, which we don't understand, they shoot up and become super Eddington for a while. It's not a sustainable thing. It's then you collapse back. And so the NOVI max out at Eddington luminosity, again, I'm being within a factor of few for the same reason, because if you supply too much energy, then they'll just drive faster and faster wind and get rid of it very quickly. Okay, so the strategy to go and find these things is like NOVI. Well, we can go find more NOVI. That's not very interesting. Supernovae, I mean, if there's one overworked field in astronomy other than GRBs, it is supernovae, which is an order of magnitude overworked. Okay, so you want to come up with a survey that avoids this and avoids that. Okay, that's easy. So the way to do this is you look at nearby galaxies and structures and clusters and set the threshold, so you'll never find any NOVI. We don't do pesky things at all. So set it so that this is it. Anything you find about the Eddington luminosity, you know, is a transient source from very basic ideas. So you'll find these things. Once in a while, you'll find a supernova. Oh, well, you know, it's inevitable. And I think there's a whole new game here. This whole new game is going to be one where coalescence matters of all sorts, and I can immediately think of, again, we are not in a Fermi-Dirac exclusion at all. This is over all possibilities. I can make a list: white dwarf neutron star, black hole, ordinary in radiative star, convective star, giant, subgiant, you know, one. Then I can make this on the other side of the matrix, and then look for all possible combinations, and make discoveries, you know, bash of paper and so on. That's sort of the game in this. Okay. So let me end on some technological things. So why now? Why now is there's a thing called Moore's law, which is his observation, was that every 18 months the transistor density doubled. Okay? So under the same thing, n proportional to 2 to the t over 18 months. Okay, but this law has less to do with transistors, more to do with the manufacturing aspects of it. Okay, it's just saying if you have enough money to be made, okay, then you can double things every 18 months. I think that's what it really is saying. okay, so, and that in fact is true in so many areas now. So, computing, okay, certainly has gone up since, you know, any of us started. It's been doubling at a very high rate. I don't know if it's 18 months or not. But for astronomers, CCD sensors, these are devices by which we make images. And they use the same sort of semiconductor technology. And then bandwidth, very important for this sort of business, bandwidth. You know, more computing, more hardware, you can pump more and more. Okay, and then storage, by which I mean disk or whatever kind of storage, that's also gone up. You know, it's no longer the day where 640K of memory should be enough for anyone. No, it's not true at all. Okay, what do these mean? These mean that particularly for this area here, that's why I said the time is ripe now for this optical incoherent imaging. Everything is set. CCDs, it was only maybe 15 years ago, getting a 256 by 256 CD was like a major thing. Well, we have this 256 square thing. And now, you can go to Sky and Telescope. They sell you a 1K by 1K for any amateur. It's sort of, you know, it's trivial. So you can now build gigapixel camera, of course, for a cost, but it's very, very small not compared to before. Okay, so this area is therefore poised to grow, but not true of the next area, radio astronomy, because I think there we need more advances, because that's coherent imaging, and that has a bit more computing. We need more sort of the wireless technology explosion has to take place in a bigger way. Maybe 5 years from now, I think that will be ready, because it's all about wireless there. But this is ready right now. Okay, so I'll make another, I don't want to call it any law, but let me make an observation, which is something to do with it. So you have a telescope. So let me make my nice telescope picture. Okay, I have a telescope. There's stuff that you have a detector here, which I call the back end. Okay. And then the data comes in, then I do some computation. Okay, so this is the B, cost for doing B. The back end is not the steel, not the concrete, not the glass. It's the stuff that goes and collects photons. Once it becomes numbers, you have to do something with it. Okay? So my observation is, you can make a cost curve. Almost all these cost curves will look like this. You can build a telescope. So if you want to say, I want to do something where I want a certain amount of collecting area, you can do it in one of two ways. Well, let's make this telescope. Number of telescopes. So you can make one where you can build a very large telescope and the cost will be completely dominated by the telescope because it's harder to build bigger and bigger structures. Okay, so this is telescope dominated. You can just go to Sky and Tell and say, oh, Celestron, please send me 1,000 Celestrons. It will be very cheap. Okay? And this is, unfortunately, back-end dominated, because if each of them has to have a gigapixel detector, and you can see that any physicist will immediately see the asymptotic limits, therefore there must be a minimum in between, and so on. Of course, you have to put in the details if you want to actually organize the project, but somewhere here in between will be the ideal sweet spot. And this is where I claim B, you get an equipartition of expenses. Okay? This is my equipartition law. And we are there now. None of the telescopes in the past reached this equipartition. Now, there's a survey called Sloan Digital Sky Survey in Astronomy. It's famous and infamous. It's famous because it was sort of, after much work, it succeeded. It's infamous because those guys said T much, much greater than, they said T. B, okay, and with any non-equipartition thing, you pay a price when you go out of equipartition. And the price Sloan guys paid was, by making this assumption, they said it was $9 million. And by the time they realized this is true, it became $80 million. Of course, if you had gone in with the right idea, it's an equipartition, probably it would have been $30 million or something like that. Okay, so my view is that we are, fortunately, thanks to empirical learning from Sloan, the equipartition of these three, especially the last one, computing, has been appreciated. And astronomers have slowly, very slowly, gotten used to the idea that B and T must be comparable. They're very uncomfortable. Most astronomers' idea, build all the big telescope. It's like, you know, buying a house. The idea is you buy biggest you can, and then you can always pay out slowly. That's exactly how astronomers think. But turns out to be, you know, an eye where technology has now made that, in fact, wrong. So I think there are a lot of possibilities now, especially those who understand this equipartition law. And so anyway, my claim is the next few years, there'll be a lot of activity. It'll have nothing to do with GRBs. It doesn't mean GRBs, things will stop or something. It just means it's a mature field. It's in a linear growth right now. But I think this field is on an exponential growth. So thanks very much.
Estimate for the number of
macro novae are correlated with LIGO estimates. Yeah. So if you make their assumptions. Actually, there are some limits. Just the fact when people look for novae in nearby galaxies, M31 and so on, they don't find any objects here. These have slowly been popping out in the last 10 years. That already tells you the empirical limit on macronova are like below a few percent of the nova rate. The nova rate in our galaxy is about 30 per year. Again, I'm being very rough. So already in a typical galaxy like ours, we can put a limit of something like below one macronova per year, which is not a major disaster to any of these calculations. So if you want to find these, you really need to do, you know, thousands of square degrees every night, because there are time scales on which, especially if it is neutron powered, it doesn't matter actually what it's powered by. As long as it has some powering, it'll last a few hours. So let me see if I can refine that number a bit. I have to think through in terms. Yeah, I can't immediately give an answer, but it's a major search to get the even the so-called unbeamed number of neutron star coalescences, which assumes that every gamma ray burst we see, there are 100, which we don't, because the macronova is independent of the orientation.
Well, yeah, the volume rate for the short hard burst is 10 per gigaparsec cubed per year.
What's that for supernovae?
5.8 or 10 to the 4.
Yeah. Okay, so. Yeah. So that tells you the scale of this thing. But my view is that, yeah, one aims for that, but there's plenty of juicy stuff like this coalescence of ordinary stars to keep us, you know, busy along the way. And so the insider tip for the young theorists is that's what you should be working on. Yeah.
Could you say a little bit more about the observing program? I mean, where is the equilibrium in terms of number of telescopes?
Well, no, that does depend on what exactly you're thinking. Okay. Well, this is a contentious issue. In radio astronomy, this has been thought through very by independent parties, and the claim is that the size of a telescope is roughly of the order of 10 meters, maybe 6, maybe 12. For millimeter wavelengths anyway, that is true, and probably even for centimeter wavelengths. That would be just, so you'd be then only, it'll be roughly. In optical, there are two schools. One is called the pan-stars group, and they think it's 2 meters is the way to go, because that's the thing you can stamp out. And LSST thinks a single 8 meter is the way to go. So I haven't really thought through this detail at all, because I in my mind, the interesting existing instruments that you can actually, you know, do something. But anyway, I'm just telling you there are two, you know, very respectable groups which have disagreed on this answer. My view would be I sort of like the idea of having more telescopes. There are many advantages. It allows for a linear, you know, allows for mistakes and so on and so forth. Oh, the radio astronomy ones are not. Okay, the millimeter one is 64 or maybe 50. The new billion-dollar SKA, I don't know. It's 1 square kilometer, so that's 10 to the 6 square meters. let's say 10 meters, so that's divided by 10 square, so that's 10 to the 4.